Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotzer coming at you live from my house. It is Monday, and it's 1 o'clock, our weekly book club class. Therefore, we'll meet right now. Welcome aboard to everybody. We are reading The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Volume 1, and this class is going to be dedicated in memory, Mr. and Mrs. Barry and Barbara Nagler, in memory of Moshe Ben Velvel, Mr. Murray Dick. May his memory be for a blessing. They were very close friends for many, many years, and may his memory be a blessing. May the Neshama have an Aliyah. In this book, we're at chapter called Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, and I've already done a little bit of this. However, I sent out an email to the community, inviting everybody to come and hear Reb Chaim Brisker as remembered by his grandson, the late great Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University. What I'm thinking of doing is I'd like to do a little bit of review and go back to page 181. Some of the pages that I read, I was like half asleep, totally exhausted from this travel or that late night or this early morning or that driving, whatever it was, over the past couple of weeks. So what I want to do is I want to do it right, and I'm going to read through it and give you the entire chapter of Chaim Brisker as best as I can. Now, there's a lot here, but I think we can do it if we get started. Feel free to ask any questions, those of you who are calling in. Of course, feel free to stop me at any time. So if you have the book, I'm on page 181, and it's from Chaim Soloveitchik, 5.01, Sukkos in Volozhin, related by the Boston Rebbe, Rebbe Levi Yitzchak Halevi Horowitz, in 1993. The Rav related that his grandfather, Chaim Brisker, Chaim Soloveitchik, spent the first Sukkos after his wedding with his father-in-law, Rebbe Rafal Shapiro, the Volozhin Rosh Yeshiva. It was raining very hard on the first night of Sukkos. Rebbe Rafal Shapiro felt that they should wait until midnight before eating, in the hope that the rain would stop, and then they could eat in the sukkah. Rebbe Chaim Brisker contended that they could eat right away, in accordance with the principle that a person who is betza'ar, who is mitzta'er, who is in a state of pain or distress, is exempt from the requirement to eat in the sukkah. On Shmini Atzeres, it was raining again, and the same problem surfaced. Only this time, Rafal Shapiro felt that they should eat in the house, while Rav Chaim Brisker was of the opinion that they should wait for the rain to stop, so they should eat in the sukkah. Lipsha Shapiro Soloveitchik, the Kala, got upset with her husband, Rav Chaim, and wanted to know why Rav Chaim was always taking issue with her father's views. So Rav Chaim Brisker explained that the first night of Sukkos is a Torah obligation. That's exactly what it is. Therefore, one may be lenient when the halacha permits such action, as in the case of rain. You can be mekel. You can be lenient. However, eating in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres, that's merely a dirabbanan. That's only a rabbinical decree. And such rabbinical decrees have to be strengthened. And therefore, it is imperative to try and eat in the sukkah on Shmini Atzeres. How about that? Next, page 182. Intellectual honesty. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik at a Talmudic lecture in Boston in 1974. The Talmud relates in Krisos 3b that Rav Acha, the son of Rav Ika, found that he contradicted himself. He then tried to refute himself. There is a Musar Haskel, an instructive lesson in this approach. It means that if you realize that there is some contradiction pertaining to your statement, then you must refute yourself. Otherwise, it is impossible to know the Torah if one is vain and proud. One must be able to admit mistakes. This was the greatness of my grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker. He always admitted when he made mistakes. I have already told you that when Reb Chaim was appointed a Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin, he was very young. There was opposition because of his youth, and particularly to his new method of analysis, which of course we know as the Brisker method right now. The alumnus of the Brisker method, some were opposed. They used to call Reb Chaim the chemist because his method resembled that of an analytical chemist. For instance, there was the Kletzker Rav, Rav Shalom Dov Ber Herenson, the rabbi of Kletzk, and the author of the Chalalei Shein. He was so in disagreement with Reb Chaim's new method that he brought charges before the board of trustees of the yeshiva of Elazhin. The Kletzker Rav claimed that Reb Chaim Brisker did not teach Torah properly and that his method was strange. The board of trustees consisted of Reuven Halevi Duenaberger, the rabbi of Duenaberg, of Dvinsk, and the author of the Rosh Leruveni, and also the board consisted of the famous Reb Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who was then the rabbi of Kovna, and Reb Yitzchak Slonimer, who was known as Reb Yitzchak Harif, and a few others. They were among the Gedolei Hador, and you can best believe it. They were among the Gedolei Hador, the rabbinic leaders of the generation. Top of page 183. So they came to Elazhin to investigate the matter. They did not know Reb Chaim, who was then a young man. He was in his 20s at the time. They came to listen to a shiur and to learn what it was all about. The shiur would determine whether Reb Chaim would be a Rosh Hashiva or not. They all came. And Reb Chaim went up and said a shiur on Yevamos. The onlookers felt that the content was good, and they were impressed with Reb Chaim as a teacher. He was a born pedagogue and a born speaker. He was not a trained orator, nor had he cultivated his oratorical ability. Yet as a teacher, Reb Chaim was bechesed elyon, par excellence. So he said the shiur, and the visiting rabbis were just enchanted. Toward the end of the shiur, Reb Chaim recalled a passage from the Rambam, which he felt refuted his analysis. It was about 5 minutes before the completion of the shiur. Had Reb Chaim finished the shiur, he would have gone down, and there would have been a spontaneous outcry of, you know, Yechi HaMelech, long live the king, from all the audience. However, Reb Chaim suddenly interrupted the shiur. This is a true story. It's not just a Chassidish Maisa. Because it's not a Chassidish Maisa, it's a true story. Laughter from the crowd in 1974. Reb Chaim declared, Rabbi Sai, gentlemen, whatever I said is wrong. I made a mistake. The Rambam says just the opposite. Then he went down. Reb Chaim remained the Rosh Yeshiva. He did not lose his job. This is seeking the truth of Torah. I remember as a child that my father trained me in a similar fashion. Whenever there is a mistake, admit it immediately. Do not try to defend errors. That is what Rav Acha, the son of Ravika, did. He declared that what he had said before was no good. That's exactly what Reb Chaim Brisker did. At that time, Reuven Duenaberger gave Reb Chaim smicha, rabbinical ordination. Reuven was the most preeminent among the visiting rabbis. Actually, he was the Gadol Hador. He invited Reb Chaim to Duenaberg, where they discussed many Talmudic topics together. Reuven then gave Reb Chaim smicha. The fact that he gave him smicha meant that he sanctioned the appointment. The appointment, of course, to Elazhin. Top page 184. The opponents of Reb Chaim had claimed that Reb Herschel Leib, known as the Netziv, Reb Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, he is also known as Reb Herschel Leib, that he had appointed Reb Chaim Brisker because of nepotism. After all, Reb Chaim Brisker was the husband of Reb Herschel Leib's granddaughter. The Netziv's granddaughter married Reb Chaim Brisker. Reb Chaim was married to Lipsha, the daughter of the Netziv's son-in-law, Reb Ephraim Shapiro. That was the charge which Reb Chaim's opponents brought against him. However, the students of the yeshiva were behind Reb Chaim Brisker. They supported him to such an extent that when Reb Herschel Leib, the Netziv, later appointed his own son, Reb Chaim Berlin, to be his successor, the students did not accept the appointment. Well, while my grandfather was at yeshiva at Elazhin, the appointment of Reb Chaim Berlin as the next head of the yeshiva did not have any chance of success. You got that? While Reb Chaim Brisker was at the yeshiva, was in the Elazhin yeshiva, so then Reb Chaim Berlin had no chance of succeeding as Rosh Yeshiva. A son is a son. And Reb Chaim Berlin was a tremendous bucky. He was conversant with all aspects of rabbinic thought. However, he did not have a profound analytical approach. Reb Chaim Berlin was a tremendous bucky, but in the sense of the scholarship of the Sfei Chemet, it was in the style of the bekiyas of Sephardic rabbis like Rabbi Avadji Yosef. That's where we ended on April 10th at Chol HaMoed in Oppenheimer's. Top page 185. The Torah reading in Vilna, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his Yachid Kala lecture on Kriyas HaTorah in Boston in 1975, says Rabbi Soloveitchik, I heard from my father, who was of course Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, that Rabbi Chaim Brisker told him that when he was a Rosh Hashiva in Volozhin, he once went to Vilna on a visit. It was a Monday or a Thursday, and Rabbi Chaim Brisker went to shul to hear the reading of the Torah. Rav Chaim went into the Kavanasha, the concentration shul, as it was called, the famous round shul. It probably started as the Chevra Kadisha shul. Anyway, he prayed there. After the cantor finished the long tachanun, supplicatory prayer following the Amida, Rav Chaim banged on the chazan, banged on the table, and he asked, who was a Balkore? Who was able to read from the Torah scroll? The regular Balkore had taken sick, and a substitute was needed. A Jew raised his hand, and the cantor asked him to come up. The Jew went up, and the Kohen was called up. The Kohen said the blessing, and the substitute, Balkore, put on his glasses, and he answered Amen solemnly. He took a look at the Torah scroll, and he exclaimed, why didn't you tell me that the Torah scroll does not have vowel points under the letters? Laughter from the crowd. This is a true story. It's amazing. I cracked up when I said it over, you know, a week or two ago, and I'm cracking up now. Obviously, this Balkore never got an Aliyah. And he's raising his hand. He's going to be the Balkore. And he has no idea. And he has no idea that the Torah scroll has no nakudos underneath. The whole thing is so mashik, it's incredible. Anyway, communal prayer, the importance of davening with a minyan, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in a shir in memory of his mother, the Rabbanit Pesia Feinstein Soloveitchik. He gave us over at YU in 1974. Prayer with the community has many extraneous aspects of great importance. Prayer with a minyan unites the people. It bonds the individual to the community. Also, the prayer itself becomes a different prayer. How long does it take you to pray when you pray by yourself? In 15 minutes, you can be finished with chakras. And even if you say the Pesukim of Zimra, the verses of praise, properly, it won't take you much longer. I know that when I pray alone, that's all it takes me. I was brought up in a house where prayer with the community was not stressed as much as reading the Torah with the community on Mondays and Thursdays. Rabbi Chaim Brisker would get off the train on these days. He would gather 10 Jews together and obtain a Sefer Torah so that he could read the Torah near the terminal. Sometimes he would catch another train that day, but many times he had to remain in the community overnight. Only the next day could he continue his journey. In those small towns, the train did not run every hour on the hour, but every 24 hours, not on the hour. On the other hand, Rav Chaim Brisker would not insist upon praying with a minyan. That was very strange, but I can explain it to you. Rav Chaim actually was involved with the study of Torah 24 hours a day. Rav Chaim had the ability to study Torah while listening to someone telling him a story, a poor woman complaining, or a person requesting a favor. While listening, he was thinking about a difficult text in the Rambam. He could be involved in a serious discussion, and at the same time, did not cease studying Torah for a single minute. For instance, people told me that they went to him for advice and guidance. After all, he was actively involved in the needs of his community. He did not just live within the four cubits of Halacha. After the fire which destroyed Brisk in 1901, Rav Chaim rebuilt the city. There were no disaster funds available from Washington, and the Tsar did not care about Brisk. Rav Chaim went to Warsaw, he went to Warsaw, and a few other cities in Poland, and he simply knocked on doors. He finally raised enough, and he rebuilt the city. Not only the communal buildings were rebuilt, but the homes of the poor. There was no insurance in Brisk, and Rav Chaim had to do it all. He was very involved with his community in an almost superhuman way, but this did not deter him from the study of Torah. I heard from rabbis, his students, and even from my father, that in the middle of listening to a person's woes and complaints, Rav Chaim Brisker would suddenly exclaim, the Rambam is right. There's no question on him. Rav Chaim would interrupt the conversation, go over to the bookcase, take the Rambam out. He'd look up the halacha, and he'd say, there's no question. My explanation is correct. He would then return to his discussion with the petitioner. This involvement with the community somehow did not interfere with his Torah study. However, when it came to prayer, You either prayed or you studied Torah. You could not do both at the same time. That is why he was not pedantic about praying with the community. But as far as we are concerned, we are not so totally involved in the study of Torah. We therefore must be careful about praying with a minyan. I realize today that praying alone and praying with the community are like two different forms of prayer. Praying alone takes a lot less time, and I don't experience the same depth of emotion as when I pray with the community. You should be very careful to pray with a minyan. Some people cite Rav Chaim to justify their not caring about public prayer. Rav Chaim had other good traits. Why cite only this behavior? However, the truth is Rav Chaim followed stringent rulings, which made it very difficult for him to pray at the community's normal prayer times. He had to recite the Shema when it was night, according to Rabbeinu Tam's view. Many times it was too late for him to detain the people in the synagogue. So he would say the Shemoneh Esrei with the community, and much later, he would recite the Shema with his blessings. In the morning, he was concerned with the viewpoint of the Magen Avraham, which meant that he had to say the Shema and its blessings much earlier than the community's prayer time. Once he recited the Shema, the morning Shemoneh Esrei immediately had to follow. There were reasons for Reb Chaim's behavior. But for plain people, the way we are, prayer with the community is very important. I don't like to preach, and I don't like to rebuke you. I mind my own business. Nevertheless, praying with a minyan is very important. Everybody should simply try to get up an hour earlier. If you study until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, simply go to bed an hour earlier, and then you'll be able to wake up in time for the minyan. The Talmud and Baba Metzia already alluded to a scholar's rising early. Rabbi Eliezer, the son of Rabbi Shimon, said, go into a tavern at the fourth hour of the day. If you see a man dozing with a cup of wine in his hand, ask him what he is. If he is a learned man, you may assume that he has arisen early to pursue his studies. A scholar will plan his day properly. To break up the concept of the community is to break up friendship, communication, and the entire concept of peoplehood. Our sages already said that even, quote, the Amei Haaretz, even the ignorant Jews, were considered ritually pure during a festival. Gemara needs a 34a. Why? The Amei Haaretz was impure because he had isolated himself from the Jewish people. He was involved in his own enterprises and business. However, when the Amei Haaretz came to Jerusalem during the festival period, even his thinking was changed. When he entered the temple on the first day of Yom Tov and he saw hundreds and thousands of Jews who had come to fulfill the divine commandment to visit the temple, the Amei Haaretz was inspired. Even though he was generally not sensitive to this concept, somehow even he softened up, gained inspiration, and joined the Jewish people. We have no mitzvah of visiting the temple today, but we do have the ability to pray with the community daily and experience this peoplehood. The Rambam stresses the importance of the community when he rules that one does not mourn for an individual who did not attend the shul and the Beis Medrash. When you do not join with the community, you break up friendship, contact, and communication between Jew and Jew. I will tell you, now that I am accustomed to praying with the community, I simply cannot pray alone anymore. The prayer is not prayer without a minyan. I simply do not experience anything when I pray alone, and there is no flavor to such prayer. This is the importance of houses of worship and study. Maimonides is not speaking about whether or not the individual did mitzvahs or sins. He is discussing the sense of belonging to the Jewish people. Through mitzvahs which you perform with other Jews, you achieve this feeling. I could take the lulav and esrog in the privacy of my bedroom. However, what a difference when I carry the lulav through the streets and come to shul where there are 500 lulavim. Willy-nilly, I integrate myself into the community. My life and my existence are interwoven into the existential texture of the community. This is the thought that my mind is stressing. You say, for instance, that Kol Yisrael are Raven, all Jews are friends. We say that in the prayer for the new month, that all the Jews are united. When the Jews observe the mitzvos, I can understand this thought that we are united and friends. I still remember in my youth that 90% of the Jewish people observed the mitzvos. There were thousands of towns, cities, villages and farms throughout White Russia, Lithuania, the Ukraine, and the Baltic countries, which were populated by hundreds of thousands of Jews. You hardly could find a Shabbos desecrator in a town. I still remember this. It may seem like a legend to you, but I can tell you that it was a reality. It was in my lifetime. My father, being a rabbi, wandered between Lithuania and White Russia. I observed these communities. How many Jews desecrated the Shabbos in my town when I was a child? Two Jews, the druggist and the doctor. The druggist was no druggist, and the doctor was no doctor. Laughter from the crowd. This was not only typical of my town, it was the norm. Under such circumstances, you could certainly say that all the Jews are friends. Call Yisrael a raven. They followed one daily schedule and a common lifestyle. Today, when they speak about all Jews being united, I cannot comprehend the concept. By what virtue are they joined together? I put on tefillin daily while my Jewish neighbor next door does not. On Yom Kippur, he can be busy cleaning up his lawn. What unites me with him? If there is no observance of mitzvahs, the last bond between Jews will disappear. This is why Maimonides stressed the serious consequences of not joining the Jewish community in the performance of the mitzvahs and in the houses of worship and study. Excuse me. These are the unifying forces and factors which enable us to be one people. Top of page 190. This will also explain the custom of lifting up the Torah scroll when we say the prayer for the new month. The truth is that there is no need to lift it up for the prayer, Yehi Ratzon, may it be your will. However, when we come to the prayer, quote, that our dispersed will be ingathered from the four corners of the earth in the fellowship of all Israel, well, then the Torah scroll should be held aloft. This prayer stresses the unity of the Jewish people. It is the Sefer Torah which unites us, and therefore we must lift it up at this point in the prayer for the new month. Why are Jews one fellowship? After all, one Jew is in Johannesburg and he sells diamonds. I'm in New York. What do I sell? Certainly not diamonds. However, if he studies the Talmud and puts on tefillin, then there is a common denominator. Torah unites us. There is actually another common denominator which is independent of Torah life. However, I don't like to base Jewish fellowship on this factor. This common denominator is based upon the fact that whoever hates me will hate him too. A mullah does not distinguish between the observant Jew and the non-observant Jew. I saw it during my experiences in Germany. Nevertheless, I wish to base this Jewish fellowship upon more positive factors. This is the philosophy behind the ruling of the Rambam. The Talmud derives many halachas regarding conversion from the Book of Ruth. The concept that the convert must take upon himself the observance of the mitzvahs is derived from Ruth's declaration that Amech Ami, your people will be my people. Velokayach Elokai, and your God will be my God. See Ruth chapter 1, verse 16. Ruth understood that the Jew must first observe the commandments of God, and second, should consider himself part of the Jewish people. He is not isolated and alone. Whatever happens to the Jewish people in general may very well happen to him. A Jew cannot think that he is safe because he is different. However, basically you cannot say, your people will be my people, unless you first understand that your God is my God. Some people preach the theory that you can say, your people shall be my people alone. Secular Zionists stress the approach that there is a union of the Jewish people without the need for your God is my God. However, this is impossible without the equation between the people and God. I know many Israelis who have come to America. When they first arrived, they kept on preaching Israeli patriotism to me. Later, they simply disappeared from the Jewish people. They intermarried and did not even live in Jewish neighborhoods. They moved out to the suburbs of Boston so they could assimilate among the Gentiles. That's why the Rambam stresses the importance of the houses of worship and study. They enable the Jew to experience his belonging to the Jewish people through the observance of the mitzvahs. Middle page 191. Justice and righteousness, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his essay, Halachic Man. The Halachic Man publicly protests against the oppression of the helpless, the defrauding of the poor, the plight of the orphan. The rich are deemed as naught in his view. He is the father of orphans, the judge of widows. My uncle, Rav Meir Bar Ilan, told me once that Rav Chaim Brisker was asked what the function of a rabbi is. Rav Chaim replied, to redress the grievances of those who are abandoned and alone, to protect the dignity of the poor, and to save the oppressed from the hands of his oppressor. Neither ritual decisions nor political leadership constitutes the main task of halachic man. Again, neither ritual decisions nor political leadership constitute the main task of halachic man. Far from it. The actualization of the ideals of justice and righteousness is the pillar of fire which halachic man follows when he, as a rabbi and teacher in Israel, serves his community. Top 192, uncircumcised Jewish infants. Once Reb Chaim of Brisk was attending a conference of outstanding Torah scholars in St. Petersburg. The item on the agenda was the question of uncircumcised infants. Should their names be entered in the official registry of the Jewish community? All the rabbis declared, it is certainly forbidden to register them, for they are not circumcised. Through this tactic, they hope to compel the assimilationists to circumcise their sons. Reb Chaim arose, and he said, my masters, please show me the halacha, which states that one who is not circumcised is not a member of the Jewish people. I am aware that a person who is not circumcised may not partake of the sacrifices or the heave offering, but I am unaware that he is devoid of the holiness belonging to the Jewish people. To be sure, if he comes of age and does not circumcise himself, he is liable to kares, excision, early death. However, he who eats blood and he who violates Shabbos are also liable to kares, to an early death. Why then do you treat the uncircumcised infant so stringently and the Sabbath violator so leniently? On the contrary, this infant has not yet sinned at all, except that his father has not fulfilled his obligation. From a political and practical perspective, and as an emergency measure, no doubt the majority was correct. However, on the basis of the pure halacha, Reb Chaim Brisker was correct, and he would not sacrifice this halachic truth even for the sake of realizing the noblest of ideas. Top page 193, the role of the rabbi, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in a lecture before the RCA Annual Convention in 1970. Rabbi Meir Berlin, top page 193, Rabbi Meir Berlin once told me that he asked his grandfather, Rabbi Chiyo Michal Epstein, the author of the Aruch HaShulchan, what was the role of the rabbi? He answered, to decide questions of Jewish law, to paskin shilas. Rabbi Meir Berlin asked the same question of my grandfather, Rabbi Chaim Brisker. He said that for guidance in Jewish law, one may go to a dayan, a rabbinical judge. However, the main role of the rabbi is to help the needy, protect the persecuted, defend the widows, and sustain orphans. In a word, acts of loving kindness. Gemilas chasadim. The truth is that the acts of Chaim in those areas were fantastic. Stories abound about the illegitimate children whom he adopted, provided for, and sent to cheder. You all know how he helped the Bundist revolutionary in Yom Kippur. He saved his life. This was the most important attribute inscribed on his tombstone, namely that he was a master of loving kindness, a Rav Chesed. And indeed, that is inscribed on his tombstone, Rav Chesed, a master of loving kindness. May we all aspire to be like Rav Chaim Brisker. Next, the master of benevolence, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his lecture before the RCA in 1968. You know that I was born into a rabbinic house. I'm not boasting, since it was not my accomplishment. I was cast into a rabbinic house without having been consulted. My family is characterized by a unique approach to the study of Torah, or lumdus. This brand of learning, which I too represent, is based upon a strictly intellectual approach. It is very impersonal, formal, and abstract. Its main thrust is to explore concepts and classify them. Prima facie, this approach has no relation to ethics and morality. In other words, on its face, you would think that the Brisker method would have nothing at all to do with ethics and morality. Top of page 194. All right, today I studied the topics of an ox that gores and the laws of the thief who pays double or five cattle and four sheep. What do these laws have to do with morality? How can a person actually sensitize his soul and grow as a moral person as a result of such topics? How can he develop finesse and refinement of spiritual perception? After all, morality is based upon spiritual perceptions. It must be intuitive, felt, part of your every breath, part of your very breath. It is very hard to explain. It cannot be rationalized, and even the simplest norm must be part of a spiritual perception. Yet all the great rabbinic scholars, the Gedolei Yisrael, represented spirituality, refined conduct, sensitivity, sympathy, compassion, and chesed, benevolence. There was no greater Baal chesed than my grandfather of Chaim Brisker. As a matter of fact, my father and my uncle insisted that the attribute of Rav HaChesed, master of benevolence, be inscribed on his tombstone. This was contrary to Rav Chaim's wishes in his testament that no titles be inscribed on his monument. They felt that this was the dominant feature of Rav Chaim's personality. In my opinion, as a chesed personality, Rav Chaim towered above his intellectual personality. He was truly great intellectually, and you know very well that Rav Chaim completely revolutionized our approach to the study of rabbinic texts. It would be impossible in America to disseminate knowledge of Torah among young boys who are also being trained in secular subjects. In order to compete with secular study, you must present to the young man in the yeshiva a method which is as precise and as exact as any method employed by modern logic, formal logic, or mathematical logic. Otherwise, if the student finds the Lumdus method obsolete and primitive, he will not continue his Torah studies. The fact is that very many students continue their Torah studies with dedication, devotion, and commitment. I greatly admire these individuals. All this proves one thing, that our methodology does not lag behind the finest modern methodologies of the scientific world. It was the creation of Chaim Brisker. Nevertheless, as a chesed personality, he towered above the intellectual personality that he represented. So if you study his volume, Chiddushei Rabbeinu Chaim HaLevi on the Rambam, the material appears to be dry, formal, and impersonal. You wonder how the knowledge of the multitude of rabbinic legal topics discussed by Rav Chaim has so much moral influence. It is strange, but this is the reality. This kind of lumdus has ennobled the character of countless generations. Somehow this lumdus extended not only to the mind, but to the heart. Somehow Torah knowledge, no matter what the substance, reflected the shortened form of the Amidah prayer. Give us understanding, O God, our God, to know your ways. On the other hand, I've also known some really great philosophers of international renown. I was in Martin Heidegger's class. He was a German existentialist philosopher. I was a good student. He continually spoke about human destiny, spiritual perceptions, and the events of that time. Nevertheless, when Hitler rose to power, the first to join the ranks of the Nazis were Heidegger and many other philosophers. Their task for the Nazis was to teach ethics. Only a few of the secular philosophers resisted the Nazi onslaught. Apparently, the rabbinic topics of an ox that gored a cow or an egg laid on a festival day enhanced the human ethical personality. Secular disciplines do not. To me, this is a puzzle. But these are facts. I know this from my personal experience. In Reb Chaim's house, there were no classical ethical texts like Chovas HaLevavos, the duties of the heart, or Rabbi Bachya ben Pekuda. There was no Mesilas Yesharim by Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, or any of the volumes of the school of the Tzol Kalanter, the founder of the Muslim movement. All Reb Chaim Brisker had was the Talmud itself, the Rambam, the Shita Mekubetzit, the Zal Ashkenazi, the Chiddushei Rabbi Akiva Eiger, and the Shulchan Aruch with the glosses of Vilna Gaon. Rav Chaim needed no library. When you believe that the Torah is divine, the Word of God ennobles your character. Its study redeems you from cruelty and vulgarity and elevates you. It gives meaning to life. Secular ethics and morality do not accomplish this. That's where we can. So we ended on April 17. Now fresh material, page 196. Unity in Serving God, related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his lecture before the RCA in 1970. Schism is intolerable in man's life. Judaism has insisted that life not be divided into two sectors, the mundane and the sacred, or the street and the synagogue, or the office and the house of worship. Unity is inherent in the very fabric of human existence. Man is confronted by his maker not only in the house of worship, where he is ready for the meeting, but also in places where he does not expect God to be found. The concept of Avodas Hashem, serving God, is associated with the entire gamut of human existence and with the complete colorful spectrum of one's life. God is worshipped not only by offering sacrifice, prayer, and frustration, but also by practicing a moral, social life. This is achieved by displaying kindness to one's fellow man, extending help to the needy, and treating one's subordinates decently. The best example and personification of such behavior was my grandfather, Reb Chaim Brisker. If you'll ask whether Reb Chaim Brisker was an Ovid Hashem, did he serve God? The answer is certainly. How? Through his acts of chesed. There are endless stories about the illegitimate children he looked after. He helped bring them up and arrange for them to study in cheder. You know the story about the revolutionary and Yom Kippur. He saved his life. That's exactly the concept behind the Ten Commandments. The commandments of chesed cannot be separated from those of faith. There is no chesed without faith, nor should faith and piety be separated from chesed. A person must express humility and modesty in addition to faith and piety. Only Jews understand this. Torah treats rituals and ethics as if they were one and identical. You shall be holy, for I am holy, says God. When you slaughter a peace offering to Hashem, you shall slaughter it to find favor for yourselves. You shall not steal, you shall not deny falsely, and you shall not lie to one another. The transition is simple. In Judaism, everything can be sacred. Not only the sacrificial service in the Holy Temple, but also the office and all the places where chesed is practiced. Courage and justice. Middle page 197. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in a lecture called the Haftaras between Pesach and Shavuos. Couldn't be more appropriate. Delivered at YU in 1979. Another task of the Kohen is to teach people how to act, and particularly the principles of justice. Verse in Ezekiel, and in a controversy they shall stand to judge. According to my ordinances shall they judge it. Deuteronomy, you shall not tremble before any man, for the judgment is God's. They are not to fear anyone. Rambam likewise includes among the tasks of the king to, quote, break the arms of the strong ones, of the evildoers. Hilchos Melachim 3. This is the administration of justice, and it is exactly what the Kohen is supposed to do. I want you to understand, we have many stories about Rabbanim of old. Germany had its stories, Lithuania had its stories, and so forth. The stories do not revolve only around their scholarship. Yes, we do have many stories that stress the scholarship of the Rabbanim, but that is not the main topic. It's not the main topic that has motivated us to tell stories about Rabbanim. The main topic motivating these stories was a sensitive conscience and sense of justice that the Rav possessed. For instance, there were many stories about my grandfather, Chaim Soloveitchik, Chaim Brisker. And please, I am not trying to somehow sell you my grandfather. First of all, he does not need to be sold. And secondly, I'm not a chassid in the sense that I tell stories in order to glorify and magnify a person. There were many stories about my grandfather's intellect. There is no doubt that he possessed great intellectual ability. In my opinion, he was one of the greatest intellects who lived at the turn of the century, not only among Jews, but among Gentiles. His intellect was tremendous. Had he been a philosopher or a scientist in any field, he would have changed the particular discipline completely. I will tell you frankly, this commands respect, but it's not the main trait of Chaim. Yes, it is true that he had an excellent head. He was a genius, no doubt about it. He was an abstract thinker and a revolutionary as far as the interpretation of halacha was concerned. He revolutionized the halacha. My father once told me, speaking about his father, Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, my father, Reb Moshe, once told me that if it were not for Reb Chaim Brisker, his own father, there would have been no possibility of teaching halacha to modern young men who have a good training in science. Reb Chaim made it possible to teach halacha to anyone, even those who are advanced in logical analysis. They will find that the halacha is just as exalted and perhaps as abstract as the most advanced of mathematical logic or analytical logic. However, I am not impressed by these abilities. They were given to Reb Chaim by the Almighty. Some people he presents with a beautiful, precious gift, while others get very little. I am more impressed with Reb Chaim's heroism as far as social justice is concerned. If there was a real socialist, not a Marine socialist, no, I'm sorry, if there was a real socialist, not a Marxist socialist, it was Reb Chaim. He possessed a most sensitive conscience and a sensitive heart, along with unlimited courage. I am telling you this so we can understand what the Torah demands of the Kohen. I have many stories about this aspect of Reb Chaim. There was once a strike in Brisk. I'm not trying to mislead you. Since who could strike in Brisk? They didn't manufacture anything. Laughter from the crowd. One article they did manufacture, however, namely matzah. So those who worked in the matzah shops went out on strike. Reb Chaim supported them and collected money to feed the people who were on strike. It was Brisk. It was not New York or Boston in 1979. It was Brisk at the turn of the century. Reb Chaim almost lost his rabbanut, his rabbanus, his rabbinical position as a result, but he did not deviate. I'll give you another example. The halacha is that if two people, a man and a woman, heaven forbid, die on the same day, the woman has to be buried first and the man after. It happened in Brisk that the most outstanding friend of Reb Chaim himself, a great scholar and lay leader of the community, Reb Chaim Zalman Lifshitz, died in the morning. This man had actually been responsible for the election of Reb Chaim as the rabbi of Brisk. Otherwise, Reb Chaim would never have been elected. At the same time, a poor woman in the Brisk ghetto passed. It was in the winter when the day is short. The Gabbaim of the Chevra Kadisha calculated that it would make no difference whether the poor woman was buried at night or by day. In Lithuania, they also used to bury at night. No one would come to her funeral anyway. Reb Chaim Zalman Lifshitz had been a pillar of the community. In the morning, he would have a big send-off. In the evening, not many people would come. They decided to bury him first, and so they began to prepare his body for the burial first. When Reb Chaim heard the story, he sent a messenger to the Chevra Kadisha to stop preparing Reb Chaim Zalman Lifshitz's body for burial. They should bury the poor woman instead first. If his burial had to take place at night as a result, it could not be helped. The Chevra Kadisha ignored his orders and continued to prepare Reb Chaim Zalman for burial. Reb Chaim Brisker took his cane, put on his coat, and took his shamus to accompany him. The shamus was actually present there, and he told me the story. They went to the house of Reb Chaim Zalman Lifshitz, his greatest and most outstanding friend. Reb Chaim Zalman had actually sacrificed himself in order to elect Reb Chaim the rabbi of Brisk. Nevertheless, Reb Chaim Brisker told the Chevra Kadisha to leave Reb Chaim Zalman's body alone and go to the ghetto in order to bury the poor woman first. This was Reb Chaim's tremendous courage. It was not because people criticized him or because he lost a few of his supporters. This was courage because he acted against himself. He himself mourned the passing of his best friend. He sacrificed his own self, his own emotions. After all, he reciprocated Reb Chaim Zalman's friendship with friendship, but he could not help it. He was a prisoner of the law. One sometimes has to have a lot of courage in order to be a prisoner of the law and to carry the law out. I can tell you hundreds of such stories. These are not stories of miracle workers. In theory, a great man with a great intellect should also have a great and sensitive heart. He should therefore possess courage. You shall not tremble before any man. That's exactly what the Torah demands of the Kohen. It is what Ezekiel meant when he declared, "And in a controversy they shall stand to judge. According to my ordinances shall they judge it." Whenever there is litigation, conflict, or two people disagreeing with each other, and the rabbi has to intervene, He shall stand upright. The Rebbe should not give in or compromise. He must enforce and implement the law. How about that? Oh, one last little piece. A scholar, yet a child. Chaim Brisker exhibited childlike qualities too. Bottom page 200. Related by Rabbi Soloveitchik in his eulogy for Chaim Heller. When it came to matters of faith and belief in God, the giants of Torah knowledge and the rabbinic leaders of the Jewish people became like little children. They approached these subjects with all the innocence, simplicity, and charm of unsophisticated youngsters. Their religious experiences were total and satiated with fervor. Whenever you took cognizance of their greatness, you also perceived their youthful exuberance. Top 201. Who was my grandfather, Chaim of Brisk? On one hand, he was a master of abstract thought, who introduced basic changes in Talmudical methodology and analysis. This was the mature of Chaim Brisker. On the other hand, he was like a simple, tender child who could not control his intense emotions and his yearnings for the sublime, refined realization of his dreams and expectations. The mature Chaim Brisker totally disciplined his intellect, and his incisive logic redefined the rich world of halacha in precise terminology and razor-sharp distinctions. This same person would also be completely swept away by an outflow of simple emotional faith, which flowed in often confusing directions to hidden spiritual and mystical realms. This was characteristic of Reb Chaim when he functioned as a mere child. Who was my late father, my teacher, if not simultaneously, both a great scholar and a tender child, both exacting intellectual brilliance and emotional simplicity merged in his personality? Okay, we'll leave it at that. There's still some more. We're on page 201. I want to thank the Nagels for, once again, for sponsoring this year in memory of Moshe Ben Velvel, Mr. Murray Dick. May his memory be for a blessing. Others are able to sponsor other shiurim that we have here at Goffman's Synagogue. For a mere $18, you can really do a lot of good, and the neshama should have an aliyah, and things go very far, even within a budget. 18 bucks is not that much, and you can really start buying up one class after the other. I mean, who's stopping you? As a Rebbe of mine, Rebbe Chanina Posner, blessed memory, would say, when he would go collecting, he'd say, Olam Haba for sale. Olam Haba for sale. You know what that means? You give a donation to a yeshiva where they learn Torah, and you're going to get your Olam Haba. You get your Olam Haba for that, for supporting Torah study. It's an amazing thing. When somebody was talking to Rabbi Aaron Kuffer, the late great Rosh Yeshiva and founder of a BMG, the Lakewood Yeshiva, and Rabbi Kuffer said to him, you know that if you support Torah, you're going to go to Olam Haba. So the guy says, Rabbi, let me get this straight. You mean to say that if I support your yeshiva where they learn Torah, I'm going to go to Olam Haba? The Kuffer says, it's exactly what I'm saying. The guy says, Rabbi, wait a second. Let me get this straight. I'm going to watch football all day on Sunday, but I'll cut you a check, and I'll get to go to Olam Haba? And the Kuffer says, of course you can go to Olam Haba based on that. But what kind of Olam Haza would you have? What kind of a life in this world are you going to have without learning Torah? What a shame that would be, not to get to know what's on God's mind. So when you realize that we have the repository of what God, not only that God has on his mind, but what he wants us to know, what's on his mind, well, then that alone is tremendous itself. And it's just libraries and libraries and libraries of depth so we can get to the bottom of things. What a privilege it is to be able to study God's Torah. Thank you so much to the Nadlers for supporting today, sponsoring today's shiur, in memory of their dear friend, Mr. Murray Dick, Moshe Ben Velvel. And you can honor a person who's alive or remember somebody who has gone on to his or her eternal reward. The choice is ours. At $18 a pop, a lot of good can be done. Thank you so much to the Nadlers. A big yishar koach to them. And thank you one all for calling in today. God willing, join us tomorrow night for Tanakh Tuesday as we continue to explore 2 Kings chapter 17. A sad, by all means, it's a sad story as we learn about the invasion of the northern kingdom of Israel and the dispersion. into Assyria. This is really where you learn about the dispersing of the 10 lost tribes. This is where it is in 2 Kings chapter 17. So please join us live at the shul at 7:30 or call in at this number. Sponsor this year if you'd like. You can email me that information at paulplotster@gmail.com. That's paulplotster@gmail.com. $18 a pop, and the Neshamas can have Elias. Wishing everybody only the best and good health. All the best. Zaitskis, everybody. See you tomorrow night at 7:30 for Tanakh Tuesday. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.